How do we become a sustainable world? As the stakes for our survival continues to rise, so does our global consciousness. We are in the midst of a great spiritual awakening and are laying the foundations for a happy, peaceful, just, and sustainable world. With clear vision, determination, and a positive attitude, we are making sustainability happen. The transformation is already underway. You are listening to Sustainable Futures.
You are listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, 93.9 Cable FM in Burnaby. We are also available on the internet at www.cjsf.ca. And if you want any information, you can call us at 778-782-CJSF. On this week's episode, Ryan discusses the future of electric vehicles with John Stonier, a spokesperson for VEVA, the Vancouver Electric Vehicle Association.
I'm a charge accountant myself, and I think the finance guys at the car company said, hey, you can't build an electric car. You guys nuts? You're going to build a car that never breaks down, never needs repairs, no aftermarket sales. They're going to last forever. And what's going to happen is we're going to see a big decline in our industry.
And our correspondent Sarah Hyde speaks with Tracy Axelson, the founder and executive director of the Cooperative Auto Network, about the origins and environmental benefits of Vancouver's car co-op.
When we went to launch, I was a 27, 28-year-old woman with little to no business experience starting a completely unheard of business. You know, in the English-speaking world anyhow. You know, this was not opening another coffee shop. It was literally something completely not on anybody's radar.
And we'll have our weekly streeters and news.
I'm Kim Tay.
And I'm Ryan Fletcher.
And you're listening to Sustainable Futures.
So today's episode is going to be on vehicles, on cars, more particularly.
Yeah, on alternative transportation. Well, I mean, it is going to be on cars, but I guess different ways of driving, not using gas-powered vehicles.
Yes, keeping the gas down.
Ryan, first up is your interview with John Stonier, who, as we mentioned earlier, is the spokesperson for VEVA, the Vancouver Electric Vehicle Association, and he's talking all about electric cars, and I've never actually driven in an electric car. Have you?
Yes, actually I have. It strikes you because there's no noise. No noise in an electric car. You drive it and then it's amazing.
That's really cool. Yeah. I have heard of that.
Yeah.
And it's catching on because of the cost of gas. More and more people do want to buy hybrid cars. Well,
yeah.
They're not. Hybrids are a little bit electric, but
sort of transitional.
So hopefully the technology will continue to develop in the next few years and hopefully they will become more accessible to more people.
Yeah, all it takes is for them to be in the market, and everyone will want one. Just listening to the way John Stonier speaks about it, that's the impression one will get. He's very enthusiastic about it. Hello, this is Ryan Fletcher on Sustainable Futures, and we have John Stonier, who is the director, treasurer, and spokesperson for VEVA, the Vancouver Electric Vehicle Association. And we're going to talk about the association here today. What is VEVA?
Well, VEVA started back in the mid-80s as a collection of enthusiasts who really thought that, you know, electric motors and electric vehicles are the way of the future and are the actual superior technology for most of our transportation needs. So things really started going with the Vancouver Electric Vehicle Association about 1987. And since that time, it's been fairly steady membership up until the last few years. You know, electric cars have a lot to offer the driving public. And in the last few years, of course, the rise in gas prices has really focused attention on electric vehicles. And in the last 3 months specifically, we've seen a huge increase in the interest in electric vehicles. Our website hits have tripled over the last 3 months. our membership meetings, our monthly meetings are basically packed to the rim, about twice as many people. Mm-hmm. And we have about 150 members right now, and about 60 to 70 of them show up every month for our meetings, where what we do every meeting is have some speaker of interest to talk about various aspects of electric vehicles, whether it's battery technology, whether it's hybrids, okay. whether it's legislation. We had a speaker from the government of BC the other month, and anything from skateboards to electric bikes to electric boats. So we have a wide range of electric right. vehicles.
Sounds electrifying. Must be quite an energy in there.
Absolutely. And, you know, it is so timely right now when people are just driving by every gas station. Look at the price of gas. We're looking at the destruction of storm damage and global warming. And people are really thinking about electric cars at this point.
Mm-hmm. So how does it feel to be an electric vehicle? Does it?
Well, probably the first thing that you'll notice is the lack of sound. There might be some whirring and humming going on as the components warm up, or mm-hmm. there are some components to do your braking and steering mechanisms that might have a pump attached to that. But essentially, they're quiet. And what happens is when you step on the gas, we'll change that word to the accelerator.
Yes.
You accelerate. And my first experience in an electric car was a friend of mine who has a 1987 Pontiac Fiero who's converted his car. He hit the accelerator, and I was just thrown into the back of the seat. I was just sort of gasping for air as he accelerated out of this intersection, and I was just incredibly impressed by the amount of torque mm-hmm. that an electric motor can apply to a car.
Mm-hmm. Are there many manufacturers around Vancouver that are making? Now I know there's a lot of people doing hybrids, but what about purely electric vehicles? Are there people that are working on that?
There are, but you know. The auto industry has some natural barriers to entry, mm-hmm. and one of the biggest barriers is just getting your engineering right and getting through crash testing. You know, crash testing, you know, round numbers, maybe that's a $10, $15 million bill just to get 30 prototypes engineered to meet all the safety standards, get them through to Transport Canada so Transport Canada can smash up 25 of them, keep 5 as controls and drive them, and it's going to take you know, years, 2-3 years to do all that. It's a huge barrier to entry. So for companies that just want to start up and create a new company, I'm going to build a new car, it's not a simple process, and it's certainly not cheap. So what we have today is we have what you may have heard of low-speed vehicles or limited-speed vehicles. And those are vehicles, one in particular was built here, right here in the Lower Mainland, called Dynasty, mm-hmm. Dynasty IT. And it's a very nice little car, cute as a button, and it performs extremely well. Again, off the line performance, great acceleration, but you know the because they don't have full Transport Canada crash testing, they meet all the other safety requirements. They have all the lighting and everything else, but they don't meet the crash testing. And so what the government did to allow them on the road is to say, well, you can drive them as long as it's limited speed. So they limited it to 40 kilometers an hour, which is really not quite acceptable as a complete substitute to the regular car.
Right.
But they're low price point. They're below $20,000 to buy. They are perfectly good for neighborhood vehicle use where you're going to the grocery store, dropping your kids off at school. Perfect for teenagers that are learning to drive. I mean, as a parent myself, I'd love to have my daughter, driving a neighborhood electric car because they can't go more than 40 kilometers an hour.
That works.
So it works for me. But they have sort of, you know, the public who has heard about electric vehicles are sometimes confused that these low-speed vehicles are the limitations of electric.
Right.
Purely a regulatory thing that enables small companies to get a product on the road, but they aren't meeting the full crash testing, and that's a problem. So getting back to your original question, there aren't a lot of people building full cars that are standalone cars. But there are now increasing number of people doing conversions, mm-hmm. taking regular cars that already have that crash testing approved by the big automakers and by Transport Canada, converting them because they're either old or basically the price of gas is too high. So,
now, is it possible to do a full conversion to completely change a motorized vehicle to an electric vehicle?
Well, you use the term motorized vehicle, and this is an interesting thing. It's
an electric motor. It's
electric motor is a motor, and an engine is an internal combustion engine. And we, just to go on that thread, you know, we continually refer to cars as motor cars. I mean, even General Motors, Mitsubishi Motors, uses the word motor when really they're really selling vehicles that have engines in them. Mm-hmm. It's an interesting thing, but it all comes back from the history of the automobile, where the electric car was the original technology, where motors were used to propel cars before the internal combustion engine.
So the term motor vehicles, that was born out of an electric motor?
Absolutely. You know, the term, you know, motoring comes from electric motors, electromagnetic force created from applying electric power to magnetic fields.
What happened then with electric motors? Why did we not use them since they are so much better? Why did we have to go into diesel and gasoline?
Well, it's a great question. And, you know, the electric car is a car that's been killed twice, right? I mean, the first time was around the early 1900s. The electric cars were easier to build in the first part. For the same reasons they're easier to build today. There's fewer moving parts. They're less complicated in a lot of ways. But back around the turn of the century, there was a couple factors. In the 1890s, there were something like 200 electric car companies. And they were all basically taking horse-drawn carriages, putting motors into them, and creating motorized vehicles. And there was a couple of dynamics. On an economic basis, the price of electricity was very expensive, and it wasn't very widely distributed. The electricity was in the cities, wasn't in the rural areas. A place like Vancouver was one of the earliest cities to actually have, you know, hydroelectric power. There's lots of pictures in the archives of whole streets filled with electric vehicles in downtown Vancouver in 1912, 1913, when electricity was the main source of energy. The cost of electricity back in those days was about 30 cents a kilowatt hour, and the price of gasoline was about 5 cents a gallon. Mm-hmm. Now today, you look at the reversal, it's now 6.5 cents per kilowatt hour and $5 a gallon for gas, you know, $1.32 a liter. So it's completely reversed. Mm-hmm. There was a couple of other things that wasn't in the favor of the electric car originally. One of them was a gas tank can contain about 10 times as much energy as a lead acid battery. For range, you just simply didn't have a comparison. Mm-hmm. Plus, for power and horsepower, the internal combustion engines by the early teens were starting to become much more efficient. They actually put starters on them, so people weren't breaking their arms trying to crank their gas engine, which they regularly did back in the turn of the century. 1912 was the year that the first starters were put, electric starters were put into gasoline engines. Mm-hmm. So the improvements in the engine, and a number of other technological advancements made the gasoline car basically unstoppable compared to the electric. And by the 1920s, virtually all the electric car companies had gone. There was none left by the end of the 20s. Mm-hmm. Now, roll forward to the 1990s. Electric cars had another false start, you might say. In 1990, the California Air Resources Board, concerned about the environment, concerned about air quality, instigated a 5% zero-emission vehicle mandate, where every car company that was going to sell cars in California had to have a minimum number of zero-emission vehicles. Mm-hmm. And what happened as a result of that legislation in 1990 was that every major car company went out and started building electric cars. Mm-hmm. The most famous of those was the EV1, made by GM Saturn Division. Now, the EV1 was a fabulous car, and a friend of mine who was renting one from Budget, you know, I picked this up at the LAX airport, and I got into the car. It was the first car I'd ever seen where you had to actually push a button to start the car. And this car just whirred to life. And it was just fabulous. You know, so we took it out on the highway. We're driving down the highway, and it had power. There was no sound. It was quiet. He said, this was a car that I just had to have. I mean, I had to have this car. And they did actually making them available to the public. They didn't sell them. They actually leased them. Mm-hmm. And what happened at the end of the lease was GM decided to pull them back and not sell them to anybody. So this is the subject of who killed the electric car. The car companies, I think, were realizing that they did have some limitations on range. Consumers were still focused on, I need to have a car that goes 500 kilometers without refueling. Or that was the perception. And car companies, I think, I'm a chartered accountant myself, mm-hmm. and I think the finance guys at the car company said, hey, you can't build an electric car. You guys nuts? You're going to build a car that never breaks down, never needs repairs, no aftermarket sales. They're going to last forever. And what's going to happen is we're going to see a big decline in our industry because we won't be producing fancy transmissions, complicated braking systems, complicated radiators, catalytic converters, da-da-da-da-da-da.
It's too good.
It's too good. So I think they came up with a brilliant idea. They said, hey, here's another technology that's emerging. It's been around for 15 years, and it's called fuel cells. Mm-hmm. So what they actually did is in 2003, the California Air Resources Board, whose complete board of directors had been changed over that period of time, decided in their wisdom that it was actually fuel cell cars that were going to be the future. So they basically killed the whole zero emission vehicle mandate. No car companies were required to produce any more electric cars. Hence, the electric car was killed for a second time.
You're listening to Sustainable Futures. This is an interview with John Stonier.
Consumers are now faced with high gas prices. Global warming has accelerated.
What does a consumer do?
Exactly.
Knowing that the answer is there, but it's not there for them.
The biggest problem with the electric car today is that it's not in showrooms. You know, Viva, we came up with a slogan that we announced on earlier this year. My next car will be electric. Mm-hmm. And basically what we're asking consumers to think about is electric cars have a lot to offer consumers. And don't go out and buy a new car until your automobile manufacturer offers one with a plug. And basically put some consumer pressure on the car companies, because the problem is they're not making them, they're not in showrooms, and they cannot be adopted on a mass basis until they are available for sale, where, you know, you don't have to convert your own car, because most people obviously can't do that.
Now, there's a question that keeps coming up to me, so I have to ask. With building new cars, there's all the material that goes into building a car, the body of the car. What are your thoughts on that? Because is that really sustainable? If people are going to be buying cars every few years, if people continue to do that, then that's not really an answer. How much goes into building the body of a car? How much material?
Well, there's a lot of material that goes into the body of a car. And, you know, there's been a lot of work done in this area. You know, the Rocky Mountain Institute and Amory Levins, and they've built a hypercar that uses ultra-light, ultra-strong carbon fiber materials. And basically these materials are totally recyclable. And because they're lighter, stronger, and basically where we need to go in the automobile industry is fewer cars, smaller cars, more aerodynamic cars, mm-hmm. and ones that can be recycled. If you went to those types of materials, you would build a car that is sustainable, that if you, you know, I've seen, you know, videotape of them taking a sledgehammer to the panels of those cars, and you can't dent them. Mm-hmm. So if you don't need to repair them, that's obviously going to be a lighter touch on the environment. It's all possible, but there's a conflict with business models. Mm-hmm. I mean, the car companies want to sell more expensive cars that, you know, literally don't last as long as people would like them to, because it does cut down their volume of business. And, you know, I think over time we're going to see a decline in the automobile industry. It's already happening now based on they're mm-hmm. building cars that aren't right for today's modern world. But, you know, that doesn't mean it's going to be disastrous for the economy. It means that consumers will have more money to spend on other things, mm-hmm. and there'll be other opportunities for business to thrive.
Different businesses.
Yeah. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. But, you know, the smart car companies today will be looking for market share, and they'll start to build the cars that will meet what customers are demanding. And as soon as more people know about electric cars, they will demand an electric car, because the technology is there today to have guilt-free motoring with no loss of performance.
What about the person that doesn't want to wait? Maybe there's people in the audience that would like to make their own electric car, just take the car that they have and fix it into an electric car. Is that possible, and is there resources for people like that?
There are resources available. You can buy kits. You know, a great place to start is go to Canadian Electric Vehicles, who sell kits. They're actually quite a successful business now in doing other things, and they're sort of they would like to help, but they're actually doing so much other work in some electric trucks that they're building that they're sort of turning down business to convert cars. But you can buy kits from them, and those kits are, you know, in the area of $10,000, something like that, for standard cars. One of the issues of conversions is, for an efficient conversion, you really have to have a light battery pack. And you can go with lead-acid battery packs. They're very heavy. They work, but you're carrying an awful lot of overhead weight in the car, and not the best conversion. It's quite limited. I think the future conversions will be lithium-ion packs with AC or DC motors that have regenerative braking. Not all kits have regenerative braking. The straight DC motors are very powerful. They use low voltage, but without regen, it's something you can be spoiled with very quickly. I mean, one of the cars I drive is a Prius, which does have regen braking. And that is, when you have that available to you, it makes so much sense. And every time you drive up a hill in an electric car and you see how much energy goes into actually pushing a car up a hill, and then you go down the other side, and all you're doing is wasting all that energy by heating up your brake pads and not recapturing some of it. Mm-hmm. It just seems to be such a waste.
Do you get enthusiastic with the braking when you have something like that?
You know what?
You can have more than you need to?
Oh, you bet. You can have a lot of fun with braking. You know, in my younger days when I had a sports car, you would, you know, downshift into second gear to slow your car down. Uh-huh. Well, in an electric car, you basically pull a lever that has maybe a variable regen, and it's maybe not as exciting as slamming a gear into second, but you can basically brake without even touching your foot pedal brake by using regen in some of these new cars. The e-box, for example, is one of those cars you can do that with.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's cool. Going back to VEVA, the Vancouver Electric Vehicle Association, is Vancouver interested in getting infrastructure for electric vehicles?
The city of Vancouver?
And is the association working towards that?
Yes, we have been working with the sustainability office at the city of Vancouver and on a number of things, and we have already helped them to get some changes to bylaws and some of the development permits. For instance, the new Olympic Village that's being built for 2010 right now in Falls Creek is going to have a higher level of plug-ins for the parking system than any other buildings ever constructed in Vancouver. You know, this is a start. We're building buildings that should last 50 to 100 years, and we have to have those buildings be able to respond to what our energy structure will be in 50 to 100 years out from now. And it's almost a certainty that we won't be driving with oil-based cars within maybe as early as 30 years from now. But as we can see, the price of oil is going to put it out of reach for a lot of people anyway, even sooner. So we need to build buildings that have the infrastructure to charge electric cars. And, you know, you can consider electric cars themselves as infrastructure. I mean, 800 million internal combustion engines on the road is an infrastructure that requires, you know, 85 million barrels of oil every day to be refined, requires 85 million barrels of oil a day to be, you know, taken out of the, extracted from the ground, refined and shipped halfway across the world to get into our gas stations. It's a huge infrastructure that's behind the internal combustion engine. We need to change that infrastructure to be electric vehicles that have a charging structure. I mean, we have electricity everywhere. I mean, we have a last six foot problem where we have to get the plugs from one side of the sidewalk to the curb side of the sidewalk. Electric cars can form part of the infrastructure from being the consumer of the energy. I mean, they are very energy efficient to begin with. They use one quarter the energy of internal combustion engines, and they essentially put more of that energy into torque as opposed to waste heat, which you get from cars. For the future, the electric cars offer something that utility companies have never considered before, and they're starting to do that now. And it's a very exciting technology called vehicle-to-grid technology, where the vehicles themselves form part of the power system, where a mobile fleet of thousands of cars on the road, when they're plugged in, when you're parked at your school, at your office, when they're plugged into the network with sophisticated and quite ordinary, actually, IP technology today, you can identify where your car is, what your billing pattern is, what the state of charge is on the car, and you can basically lend energy into the grid when the grid needs to fill its load peaks. And basically this becomes an opportunity for utilities to load manage their requirements and actually take the pressure off transmission systems in the greater grid. This is a technology that is being developed by a number of people down in the States, and it has huge potential for the future as our grid has problems with keeping up with peak load demands.
Thank you very much for spending time with us today, John Stonier. This is Ryan Fletcher on Sustainable Futures.
Coming up next, we have an interview with Tracy Axelson, who is the founder and executive director of the Cooperative Auto Network here in Vancouver. Now, this is really, really cool because they are proliferating all over Vancouver. There's so many co-op cars all over Vancouver, especially in certain areas like Kitts, Granville Island area. And Tracy Axelson is actually an SFU grad.
Yay, SFU.
Yeah, so hey, even better. Even more of a connection. And I think it's really cool. She started it out when there really wasn't even the idea of having this type of thing in Vancouver. It's kind of the trendsetter. So I'm really excited about this interview. Thank you so much, Sarah, for doing it. Here's Tracy Axelson.
Hi, I'm Sarah Hyde for Sustainable Futures. Most people don't need a car every hour of the day. Maybe people who make their living driving, like cab drivers or truck drivers. But for the majority of us, we don't use our car all day. The Cooperative Auto Network is a cooperative not-for-profit that lets people car share. So instead of owning a car, you can share one between a bunch of people. Actually, you can share a bunch of cars between a bunch of people. This equation equals less cars on the road, which has major environmental payoffs. I interviewed the founder of the Cooperative Auto Network to find out how car sharing can help people live more sustainably.
Hi, I'm Tracy Axelson, the executive director, founder of the Cooperative Auto Network. I first heard about car sharing as it existed in the world in Germany. I was at a friend's house, and I asked about what he might be thinking about in terms of alternatives to a car when, you know, we're looking for alternatives. And he just said, well, what about car sharing? And he showed me a 3-minute video clip that he had taken from CNN. And I went, perfect. You know, it really got me thinking. And I went, you know what, that's the perfect thing for me. If it works for me, I'm honestly the most average person you could meet. It will work for, you know, the average person, absolutely.
Okay, so how did you start the Cooperative Auto Network here in BC?
It was a big task, but luckily I was young enough and sort of naive enough to
How old were you?
I was 27.
Okay.
When we started putting the car co-op together, and it was just, you know, I was a, you know, when we went to launch, I was a 27, 28-year-old woman with little to no business experience starting a completely unheard of business, you know, in the English-speaking world anyhow. So it,
wow.
I still laugh when I think about that. You know, this was not opening another coffee shop. It was literally something completely not on anybody's radar. It was a thought and people kind of thought, well, that'd be interesting, and oh yeah, it works in Europe, but it would never work here. And then I said, oh, but there is one in Quebec City. What do you guys think about that? And they were like, oh yeah, but you know, the people in Quebec City, they're basically European as well, so you know, it'll work there, but it won't work anywhere else in North America. Now I think there are more cars being shared in North America than in Europe.
Wow. Okay. So how did you convince them then?
You know, success.
Okay.
That's going to be your biggest way of convincing people. Is people were, you know, at least at the beginning, certain that you'd never get anybody to sign up. And of course, people signed up. People started doing it. People start, you know, really made the switch. And even some of the naysayers, which was pretty impressive. You know, they came and they said, yeah, okay, let's give this a try. And, you know, one of the first few fellows to sign up, he literally put his car just, you know, in the garage with the storage insurance, making sure that he still had it if we went under or it didn't work for him or what have you. And I think 5 years later, he sold it.
how did you start up in terms of having the financial backing?
Oh, you know, we are blessed because we are a cooperative. We got a grant from VanCity for $20,000 from their Community Economic Development Fund that they had at the time. And we received matching contribution from the Cooperators Insurance Company. So we had $40,000 in grants, like months before we were even ready to go.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And then, of course, VanCity came to the table with the ability for, you know, I and my husband to personally sign a $45,000 loan agreement. You know, and we had another member of the board who signed on to that as well. And so we were, you know, we had enough money for the cars, and enough money to kind of pay me.
And how many cars did you start up with?
We started with two. Yeah, there were two cars in the West End, and they were like 10 blocks apart. And we quickly put a car in Kitsilano, and then one at the Main Street SkyTrain station. Because, you know, as a co-op, we have an interesting sort of iteration in that, you know, customer service is vital and important to us, but because it's more than that, it's member services. And when it's member services, we have to meet the needs of our members. Like, they are our owners. They are the people who are saying, you know, I have invested in this company, and my investment means this. And frankly, when we have enough people in a given area, we have to meet their needs in some way. So, you know, putting one at the Main Street SkyTrain station, people are like, oh, God, you know, you'll have tons of break-ins. And, you know, no, it's not been like that ever.
Sorry. And so in terms of getting members, did it take you a while to get members?
We started with 16. We didn't even sort of put a car out there until we knew that we had sort of a sustaining group of people that we felt was enough to make a go of it and a start of it. So we started with the 16. It was cool, funky people that were, you know, some people that lived on a boat and found that they didn't need a car every single day of their life and because they were in the boat. And other people who just, they were running a business, and another person who got his business to sign him up. Many of them are still with us today.
Did you promote it? Like, how did you promote it?
Oh, God. You know, this was back in the days when it wasn't illegal to put up, like, handbills on every sort of telephone post and stuff like that.
You promoted the car co-op by putting up bills on telephone posts?
Yes, I did. I mean, anything as far as marketing goes that was free, this is what I did. I mean, I went and, you know, there was those Kinko's and there was the MY office in the West End, and I just went to places like that and got things printed and was putting them up all over the place and making my own brochures and folding them myself. And oh, you know what I mean?
That's amazing. Oh. Why do you think that car sharing is, why do you think it will make things more sustainable?
I believe in the car sharing model on so many levels. I believe that it will strengthen local economies because local people will shop locally. Like, you know, if you don't own a car every single day of the week, booking a car to go to a big box store, it just no longer makes sense. Like, for the $5 you're going to spend, you save on your, you know, shopping bill, you might as well just go to the local store and buy it here. And you won't save, you'll save time. You'll probably save money over driving as well. So it stops a certain amount of economic leakage, which is a huge thing when we're talking about sustainability. You know, just being part of a co-op, getting people to understand that sharing is an option, and really gets people thinking about how else they can share and what else they can share and what more they can do. People are saving money in a big way over owning a car, and because they're saving money, they can easily use that money to better themselves, to pay off bills, to, you know, just generally make themselves more self-sustaining. Then, of course, we can get into the environment. environmental stuff as well, right? I mean, we have cleaner air, we have cleaner water, we have less congested streets, we have safer streets, there's less noise. All of this because we're reducing auto dependency and auto dominance. I'm the red-green of car sharing. Red-green, he thinks that everything can be fixed with WD-40 and duct tape. I totally believe that everything can be fixed with car sharing. We could even sell ourselves as a weight loss system because people lose weight when they join us because they're walking and cycling more than they ever did before.
That should be your next advertising campaign for sure. Is the fact right now that the gas is so expensive, have you noticed like a change in membership just recently? Like, are you getting more people?
We are certainly hearing members say, oh my God, gas is so expensive. And because gas is so expensive, we've made the decision to sort of like look at our other expenses associated with the car and downsize, right? And
yeah,
make it better, easier, all of those things, certainly. But we don't really skirt people from gas prices. We pay for the gas, right? Like,
right.
Car co-op, it's all rolled into your costs and stuff like that. But there is what we call a fuel fluctuation adjustment.
Okay.
And that's a per kilometer cost as well. And so people know, certainly, that every kilometer has a cost, and they know what the costs of the rising cost of fuel are. Well, I believe that more and more people are looking at the whole costs associated with an automobile. I'm glad that we're here to stand in as a way to make their finances still work. If somebody were to ask me, where is car sharing in the next 50 years?
Where is car sharing in the next 50 years?
<I'd ask. laughs> Well, you know, cars are relatively new things. In a century, they have probably become the dominant species on the planet. But a century ago, they were actually quite rare. You know, people still use transit, right? And
yeah.
Trains and
horses.
Horses a lot. And when you look at how people managed their transportation prior to cars, not everybody could afford to own a horse. And so they shared horses. They shared horses on the farm. I honestly believe that in the next, 20 to 50 years, car sharing will actually become a dominant form of how people will utilize cars, because I believe the ownership model is going to shift. People can't really afford, not most people anyhow, the just incredibly expensive alternatives to the automobile. I know that those alternatives are going to come down in price, but not in any way are wages going to keep pace, because not only will moving us around be more expensive, moving food around is going to be more expensive, building everything is, going to be more expensive. And the only way that sort of a lot of people are going to be able to make sense of the expense is to share a car and really localize themselves. There's a recent study done here in Canada where 6 million Canadians were basically tracked by their cell phone tower kind of relays. And of course, they didn't know they were being tracked.
Oh, this is a scary
thinking
survey.
That there's 6 million customers, we kind of know who did the tracking. It was understood that the overwhelming majority, 80% of people, rarely go more than 10 kilometers from their home. You know what I know about 10 kilometers? Eminently cyclable, walkable, and we can make our life work in that same zone without a car.
You're listening to Sustainable Futures, and this is an interview with Tracy Axelson.
With the gas prices, you haven't necessarily noticed an increased membership like right now?
Yes, we're certainly seeing an increase, but the increase is still following on our own projections as to what the increases were going to be.
Huh. So how many members do you have now?
5,000.
And how many cars do you have on the road right now?
225.
That's a lot. And you're getting cars like in others, like other areas now too, hey? Like
we
you have
are.
One on the island, a few on the island and stuff?
We've had a car in Nanaimo for about 5 years now. We're putting another one there soon. We're putting a car in Comox. It was supplied by a developer, so, you know, we're putting a car. We just put two cars at Horseshoe Bay.
Oh, wow, that's great.
Yeah, it'll be really easy, and I think BC Ferries will like that we're there as well. It'll mean, you know.
Yeah, people will use it to get on BC Ferries.
You know, and so, yeah, we're branching out. But again, it's mostly about meeting our members' needs. Like, that's where they are. So we kind of have to. We're about to put a car in Richmond. We're about to put a car in Surrey. We're putting two cars in West Vancouver. So, yeah, it's very good. It's almost like we're at the tipping point. I'm not sure if we're quite there yet, but, yeah, it feels good. It feels like, you know, I can almost sit back and relax.
When you're selecting cars to get, do you think about things like fuel efficiency?
Absolutely. I'm looking into, like, you know, in the next 5 years, what kind of electrics I'm going to have.
Do you think it's been easier starting this in BC than it would have been to start it somewhere else?
Absolutely, because of ICBC. Yeah, isn't that weird? Usually ICBC is seen as this great big hindrance, but for us, it actually meant, again, that they had to come up with a plan for us. In other jurisdictions, you know, it's private insurers, and they're sort of going, are you kidding me? You want me to do what? No. How about... No.
Really?
Whereas with ICBC, it's like, okay, well, what we're going to do is we're going to put you in as a rental car, and let's figure this out. And so we've been doing a lot of figuring out with them for, you know, a decade or so. It's been great. You know, again, it wouldn't have been easy to start this anywhere else.
You guys now have a program where you can learn to drive on a co-op car?
That's right.
Did that push come from members asking for that?
Absolutely. Because we're a co-op, right, that's one of the things about us being a co-op is, you know, our responding to the needs of our membership. And, you know, it wasn't just about, you know, my son is now 16 and wants to learn to drive, so
yeah,
what can I do? It was also, you know, my husband never got a driver's license, and he needs to get a driver's license. Tracy, what can we do to get him a driver's license that isn't going to cost us a fortune?
Have you had, like, a lot of accidents with your cars?
You know, we've had certainly a number of accidents with our cars, for sure. Not nearly as many as, you know, sort of the general world. But our cars, of course, are used, like, most people, like, most cars in the world, like, are used an average of 3 hours a day.
Right.
Just a horrific waste. Mm-hmm. Makes me crazy when I think of the waste. Anyhow, and so our cars are used a minimum of 9 to 14 hours a day.
Your hardworking cars.
So we're utilizing the resource, definitely, right?
Yeah.
And making the most of, you know, just in the car's creation, it's 30% of the environmental damage that the car will ever do is created when it is created. So, you know, we want to make the most of what's already been done. So our cars are out there more than most cars would be. And that makes for, you know, more accidents, more things that can go wrong.
I heard in terms of developing, you guys have a deal where if they, like, put in a car co-op spot, they can make less parking?
That's right. It was actually something that I put sort of two and two together. When I was putting the car co-op together, of course, I was learning more and more about alternatives. And one of the biggest, you know, issues that people have, you know, is that why are we making so much space for cars when we're not making enough space for alternatives? And I thought, well, why even make the space for the cars at all? Like, reduce the number of spaces that the cars are in, put a car co-op in that same place. You're going to get the same amount of driving done. But, hey, wouldn't it be great if we were actually reducing the amount of, like, sort of digging into the ground and destroying our water tables and groundwater systems and, you know, there's not as much concrete and lime and, you know, all of that stuff that goes into these holes once they're dug. And, you know, at the end of the day, like, you know, no more empty parkades that are sitting there underutilized. And the costs associated with building a parking spot are incredible and increasing. And so
how much does it cost to build a parking spot?
On P1, in 3 years ago, it was about $20,000 a stall. P2, you're looking at a $10,000 a level.
Wow.
So P1 is 20, P2 is 30, P4 is $40,000 per stall. A lot of it is driven by marketing, right? And yeah. It's like, well, you can't buy a place without a parking spot because think of your resale value, right? I mean, even if you don't want, you know, a parking spot yourself, like, it's immediately, oh, but what about my resale value? Well, your resale value is going to be identical, except for that, you know, $40,000 that you didn't spend getting, you know, the worst, parking spot in the building. It's just an interesting equation in people's minds. I know that I personally, I like having my parking spot underneath because it's a great place to store my bike. Nevertheless, right, you know, we worked with the city, we worked with a local developer, and we made it possible for right from the development start to get the development such that they don't have to build as many parking spots if they put us in. And, you know, for the most part, what they've done is increased visitor parking, or one developer I know of got rid of the entire P4 in a very large downtown Vancouver development.
What's the equation like for putting in one of your spots? How many do they not need to build?
Anywhere in the Lower Mainland, it can be between 3 cars and 6 cars parking spots that they don't have to put in. It's pretty great.
That's great too, because that speaks dollars as well to developers.
It saves so much money, and it's just, to me, like, I think about when the cars no longer dominate, I wonder how the developers are going to be developing these, like, sort of underground storage facilities to make them places where people can live, you know, because, like, oh, are they going to have, like, photo-optic walls that are going to look like windows, or, you know, what are we going to do, because these spaces are going to be useless. And again, you know, I know I'm the red-green show, but that's totally how I feel. It's a win-win-win-win. It's a win on so many different levels. And, you know, one of the things that we want to do right now is work out a way to supply not just a car, but a driver for people who are aged or infirm. Because it is another way that the dynamic of our planet is changing. And you know, there's a need out there and a niche that, you know, people really need this kind of assistance. And it's a whole new thing for us. And, you know, you'd think that I'd be worn out by now, and I am. But it really is just another great opportunity to say, you see, car sharing, it fixes everything.
That was Tracy Axelson, the founder of the Cooperative Auto Network. If you want more information about the Cooperative Auto Network, you can go to cooperativeauto.net and find out all the information you could possibly want to know and more. I'm Sarah Hyde, and you're listening to Sustainable Futures.
And now, here is this week's Streeters.
What is your main mode of transportation right now?
I try to walk. If I have to go far, I do take a car. I don't take the bus very much, I have to say. I walk, I try to bike, but I'm afraid of traffic on my bike. So, yeah, walking would be the main one.
Have you ever heard of the Cooperative Auto Network?
I've heard of some kind of sharing of autos, but I don't know if that's the one.
Would you ever consider joining one?
I work at home right now, so I probably won't need it. My husband bikes to work, so he probably won't need it. So, you know, if the circumstances were right, I would. We're looking for ways to minimize our driving.
Would you ever consider buying an electric vehicle?
Oh, yeah. That would be fun. I would. I just don't know what's available and what's really good out there.
What makes you think that it would be fun?
Not so much fun, but, you know, I have been sort of in the back of my mind thinking that when we change vehicles, that it'd be nice to get a hybrid or something that would be a greener alternative.
Can you tell me what your main mode of transportation is?
Car. And then by foot.
And have you ever heard of the Cooperative Auto Network?
No.
It's an organization where you basically share a bunch of cars with a bunch of people. Would that be something that you would ever consider doing?
Not when you're retired.
What about buying an electric vehicle?
Not at this present time.
Why is that?
Well, the extra output for something that hasn't been completely proven, I guess. But most of them aren't, you know, legal in Vancouver yet. So that's a big problem. You know, even if you wanted to go to a store or something, is get a vehicle that only does 30 kilometers, then you can't get it on the highway or on the road to get to a store or park or golf course or wherever you wanted to go.
What's your main mode of transportation?
Car.
Have you ever heard of the Cooperative Auto Network?
Yeah, but I don't know much information about it, no.
Would it be something like sharing cars with other people? Would that be something that you would ever consider?
Well, I have really strange hours to go to work. So it doesn't usually work for me. And when I do my trips, like appointments and exercise, I combine all my trips together. So I don't think anybody would be doing my trips.
Would you ever consider buying an electric vehicle?
Oh, yes, yes.
Why would that be?
Just for the environment.
What's your main mode of transportation?
I drive a minivan.
Have you ever heard of the Cooperative Auto Network?
Yes, I have.
Would you ever consider joining an auto co-op?
I would if it went to my job site every day. And I guess it depends where I was stationed.
What about buying an electric vehicle? Would you ever consider doing that?
I guess if the price was right, and also if more gas stations had the capabilities of recharging it.
So cost would be one of the main reasons why you're not looking into it right now.
Yes, that's correct.
And now for this week's environmental news update. 21,000 Canadians will die prematurely this year due to the effects of air pollution, and this number is expected to rise in the next two decades. The report published by the Canadian Medical Association on Wednesday demonstrated the health and economic costs of air pollution. It showed that air pollution affects people across Canada differently. Premature pollution-related deaths will be concentrated in Ontario and Quebec. While only 62% of Canadians live in central Canada, a whopping 70% of all premature deaths caused by air pollution this year will occur there. Air pollution will also affect the most vulnerable groups of people disproportionately. Seniors, for example, will make up over 80% of premature deaths caused this year by acute air pollution. Researchers studied the effects of particle matter and ozone on human health and also found that high levels of pollution will affect the economy. In 2008, the economic cost of air pollution will be $10 billion, and by 2031, this is expected to rise to $300 billion. The report is titled No Breathing Room, National Illness Costs of Air Pollution, and if you would like to view the report, you can go to www.cma.ca. When it comes to energy, BC is at the top of the class. The province has just been given top marks for energy efficiency in the Canadian Energy Efficiency Alliance's National Energy Efficiency Report Card, released on Wednesday. This report card is issued every 2 years, and this year BC improved its grade from a B in 2005 to an A+ for 2007. The Alliance praised BC for taking a huge step forward and for developing the 2007 BC Energy Plan. Manitoba also received an A+, while Quebec and Ottawa received A's. At the bottom of the class, Prince Edward Island was given a D, and Alberta and Newfoundland and Labrador both received a D+. Every 2 years, the Canadian Energy Efficiency Alliance evaluates each province on 9 criteria, including the province's responsiveness to energy efficiency issues in key legislation, whether the government led by example, and how it regulated the energy market. Believe it or not, algae has something to say about water contamination, and scientists are listening. Scientists in Israel have discovered a new way to determine water quality. By shooting a laser beam into water, scientists are able to simulate photosynthesis. Some of the heat is transferred back into the water, and this creates sound waves. These underwater sound waves can be analyzed to determine the health of the algae and the condition of the surrounding water. Algae will emit different sound waves depending on their condition. For example, algae with lead poisoning sounds different from algae suffering from iron deficiency. By listening to the algae, it is easier to determine water quality than by using more labor-intensive conventional water testing methods. NBA basketball superstar Yao Ming has been named the first ever environmental champion by UNEP, the United Nations Environment Program. As an environmental champion, Ming pledged to work with governments, private businesses, and the public to promote effective environmental management. He said that he wanted to inspire the youth to plant trees, collect rainwater, and become environmental champions of their own communities. Yao Ming is a member of the Chinese Olympic basketball team and carried his country's flag in the opening ceremonies in Beijing. And that's been your environmental news update for Friday, August the 15th.
Well, that was quite a moving show on transportation.
I think it sped along quite nicely.
Yes, yes.
Yeah, some really interesting perspectives, some new ideas, some new technology as well. And I think that they're all very applicable to a lot of people these days. And I hope that they just, you know, keep on coming.
I think transportation That's key because it's most visible. It's the most visible issue in sustainability. And everyone can latch on to that one. And it's a good starting point with everything else.
I think it's really key as well because it not only has to do with gas and global warming and that connection, but also it has to do with air pollution and our health. I mean, we depend on air. And if we're putting toxins from exhaust into the environment, we're breathing that in. And I think that people need to make that connection again. What we do to the environment, we do to ourselves.
I'm Ryan Fletcher.
And I'm Kim Tay.
And we are wishing you
a sustainable future.